This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, March 13th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, U.S. lawmakers hear from survivors of sexual assault in the military as they describe a lack of accountability.
On the officer side, there was definitely a sense of an old boys club, colonels protecting lieutenants, colonels protecting staff sergeants.
New York residents call for justice after the police shooting of a teen in Brooklyn. And we'll go to the Republic of Mauritius in the Indian Ocean, where the Chagos community is still fighting to return to their home after decades of removal. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. Legislation to allow same-sex marriage in New Zealand passed a second reading in Parliament Tuesday night. The measure received resounding support in a 77-44 vote. Lawmakers also defeated an amendment that would have sent the issue to public ballot. There will be one more vote before same-sex marriage is legalized, but the wide support last night strongly indicates the measure will see final passage. Suspected militants attacked a paramilitary post in Indian-administered Kashmir this morning, killing five people. Two of the militants were killed in subsequent fighting. It's the first such attack in Kashmir in 3 years. FSRN's Shanawaz Khan is in Srinagar, where the violence occurred.
Militants attacked a camp of a major Indian paramilitary group called the Central Reserve Police Force. Police said militants disguised as cricket players attacked from the grounds of a nearby school. Apart from the seven fatalities, at least 10 people were wounded. The Kashmiri guerrilla group Hizbul Mujahideen claimed responsibility for the Fidayeen, a type of suicide mission where armed assailants expect to die in gun battles. Tensions soared in Srinagar after the attack. Paramilitary soldiers, reportedly traveling to donate blood to their injured colleagues, allegedly opened fire on passers-by, killing one civilian. Paramilitary said the vehicle was attacked with stones by local youth. Authorities imposed a curfew to prevent further protests over the civilian killing. Shanawaz Khan, FSRN, Srinagar.
Lawmakers in Tunisia approved a new government today in a confidence vote. Turmoil has recently plagued the Islamist-led country, where a street vendor self-immolated in 2010 and sparked popular uprisings in several Arab countries. Echoing that protest, another man set himself on fire in Tunis Tuesday. Media report the young man had been unable to find work in the economically crippled country. He died this morning. The U.S. issued a statement pressing the new government to set a solid date for national elections. Today, white smoke rose over the Vatican in Rome as Catholic cardinals selected the new pope. Tens of thousands of people gathered in St. Peter's Square to hear the announcement that Argentinian Jorge Mario Bergoglio will be the next pontiff. He will be known as Pope Francis. Residents of the Falkland Islands want to remain a UK overseas territory, according to the results of a vote this week. The referendum followed renewed claims by Argentina to the islands, which it calls the Malvinas. Argentine officials argue most of the residents of the islands are British transplants, so the result was a foregone conclusion. The government says its territorial claims transcend issues of self-determination. From Buenos Aires, FSRN's Eilish O'Neill has more.
On Tuesday, Argentine President Cristina Kirchner responded to the referendum by calling it a parody by a community of squatters. The current population of the islands is comprised largely of the descendants of a group of British citizens who arrived in 1833. But Argentine political scientist Carlos Escudé says the issue of who has the right to the islands is more complicated than either the British or the Argentines recognize.
Yes, it is indeed true that the Falkland Islanders want to remain British. Yes, it is indeed true that in 1833 the territory was usurped by Britain. And third, yes, it is indeed true that the British have never honored any principle of self-determination if it was not in their interest.
More than 90% of the eligible voters on the islands turned out, and only 3 of the 1,500 ballots cast were against remaining a British territory. Large oil reserves have been found near the islands, and more discoveries are expected, further heightening the conflict. Eilish O'Neill, FSRN, Buenos Aires.
Privacy and consumer rights advocates are criticizing a settlement with Google today as being too low to be a significant deterrent. Google collected data from unsecured wireless networks while photographing communities for its Street View service. More than 30 states are party to a $7 million settlement, which was announced yesterday. Connecticut Attorney General George Jepson played down the dollar amount, saying other provisions of the settlement will protect consumer privacy.
Consumers have a reasonable expectation of privacy. Google recognizes that right through this agreement, which ensures that the company will not engage in similar practices in the future.
Google says none of the data has been or will be used in any product or service. According to the privacy group Epic, more than a dozen countries worldwide have either issued sanctions or are investigating Google's Street View data collection activities. And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. In Steubenville, Ohio, two high school football players go to court today. They're accused of raping a 16-year-old female classmate. The public trial on the small-town case has put a spotlight on universal problems of victim blaming, the protections afforded to athletes, and a culture that encourages and excuses rape. As that trial begins, lawmakers on Capitol Hill are investigating how similar crimes in the military do or do not get prosecuted. Sexual assault survivors testified before a Senate committee today about rape and sexism in the armed forces, the lack of accountability that allows rapists to continue serving, and why prevention messages should be aimed at perpetrators, not victims. In Washington, D.C., FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
More than 19,000 U.S. service members are raped or sexually assaulted every year, according to the Pentagon, though less than 15% of survivors report the crime. Lawmakers introduced several pieces of legislation this week that take aim at the widespread problem. California Democrat Jackie Speier and Missouri Democrat Claire McCaskill introduced separate bills to change how the military justice system handles rape charges, stripping commanders of the power to overturn or reduce sentences for rapists, which they can currently do without having to provide an explanation. At a Senate hearing Wednesday, McCaskill said this will bring justice to survivors and serve as a deterrent for future assaults.
The only way that victims of sexual assault are going to feel empowered in the military is when they finally believe that the focus on the military is to get these guys and put them in prison. So I believe that the focus of our efforts should be on effective prosecution.
Lawmakers also introduced the Ruth Moore Act in the House and Senate, which will aid veteran sexual assault survivors in navigating the bureaucracy at the Department of Veterans Affairs and getting adequate medical care for both physical and mental injuries. Army veteran Bridget McCoy told the Armed Services Committee about her own struggle to claim her VA benefits after being raped while serving overseas during the Gulf War.
I was anxious and overly protective. I became suicidal and had suicidal attempts. I went through severe depression and had multiple severe medical illnesses and was unable to carry on the rigors of work and was homeless and medically disabled. But not even the VA would recognize this and help me till some two decades later. It took probably 2 years for them to finally get me processed and send me a document stating my injuries were service-connected, but there was 0% compensation. It was 22 years before I actually received some response to the military sexual trauma portion of the case, my benefits.
The majority of Wednesday's hearing focused on what else can be done to aid survivors of sexual assault and prevent it in the first place. One survivor said the Pentagon needs to fully implement the new order allowing women in combat, which will lead to more gender equality among officers. Another said that those who report rape should be allowed to transfer to another unit instead of having to continue serving with their attacker during the investigation. Another suggested that survivors be given access to civilian courts if they feel that military courts are failing them. The witnesses also highlighted that most of the public dialogue around military sexual assault focuses on female victims, as do most of the Pentagon's awareness and training campaigns, including messages like, "I got her out of there." While women do account for 88% of sexual assault cases completely investigated by the Pentagon, the Department of Veteran Affairs reports that almost as many men as women are treated for military sexual trauma. Former Navy officer Brian Lewis, the first male veteran to testify before Congress on this issue, said he is one of thousands of men who have been raped by a superior officer, and described the culture of shame and silence that he discovered.
The culture of victim blaming and retaliation while failing to punish the perpetrator must end. Hearing one of my senior members of my chain of command come to me and say, "You are not going to report this." That is devastating to any survivor, male, female, whatever.
Lewis and the other survivors said future military training about rape and sexual assault should start right at the recruitment stage and be more aimed at educating people about the definition of consent and treating all service members with respect. The Pentagon recently began working with the organization Men Can Stop Rape to hold trainings and distribute educational literature. But a spokesperson with the group said those campaigns, with the slogans "Hurts One, Affects All" and "My Strength is for Defending," have so far only focused on encouraging male bystanders to intervene. He hopes the military will eventually ask them to design a different message, aimed at addressing the attitude and culture that facilitates rape. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
In New York, the recent slaying of a teenager by a police officer has sparked violence and outrage in the city. The killing of Kimani Gray was the second high-profile death attributed to a member of the New York Police in the Brooklyn neighborhood of East Flatbush in less than a year. As residents call for accountability, the atmosphere on the streets is tense. FSRN's Peter Rue has more.
Approximately 100 protesters gathered on Church Avenue in Brooklyn Tuesday night. Police, too, came out in force. As demonstrators marched to a local precinct, a scuffle broke out. One demonstrator was tackled by officers and arrested for reasons that are opaque. Contacted by FSRN, a representative of the 67th Precinct declined to comment on the charge. The circumstances surrounding the death of Kimani Kiki Gray are also a mystery. The 16-year-old was shot multiple times by undercover officers Saturday following a party. Police say a revolver was found in the teenager's possession, though no shots have been fired from it. Kiana Koch paints a different picture of the young man, portrayed by many media outlets as a delinquent.
Well, he used to come in my sister's shop a lot with my cousin, and he would come sit, buy gummy bears.
Her and Gray were friends, and she still finds herself talking about him in the present tense.
He's, like, mad cool to joke around with. Like, you know, not everybody's a saint, but, you know, everybody has their faults. We're kids. Like, we just want to live. But, I mean, nobody deserves to die like that.
Witness accounts of Gray's death vary, with some saying officers failed to identify themselves. Another told the New York Times that officers stood over Gray while he pleaded for his life. One thing that is certain, the killing has set the neighborhood on edge. A memorial service for the slain teen Monday turned into what media have described as a riot. Clashes broke out between police and mourners, many of them young friends of Gray's. Brooklyn activist Jose LaSalle says the violence was an expression of the resentment many youth in the city feel toward the police.
If they find themselves in the park, police is in there harassing them. If they find themselves in the corner just hanging, talking among their friend, police is harassing them. So, I mean, that's a lot of pressure. Psychologically, that's going to, you know, create an environment of anger and an environment of hate towards the police department.
LaSalle is an organizer with the Stop, Stop, and Frisk Freedom Fighters. He says the NYPD's practice of arbitrarily stopping and searching many young people of color and the slaying of Kimani Gray are part of the same systemic pattern of repression from the New York Police Department. Only a mass movement, he says, will curb these attacks on residents.
I'm talking about millions of people gathering together to the point where, you know what I'm saying, we outnumber police by 10. You know, so they could realize that this has gotten to a boiling point where it's about to spill, and they are the ones that's going to feel, you know what I'm saying, you know, the waterfall when it hits the floor. They're going to feel the tsunami.
Just blocks from where Gray perished rests the site of another high-profile police killing. unarmed 23-year-old Chantel Davis was shot and killed last June by narcotics officer Philip Atkins after crashing a vehicle police say was stolen. Officer Atkins has appeared in court multiple times throughout his career to settle allegations of brutality and false arrests. The Brooklyn District Attorney's Office said they will decide whether to file a grand jury indictment against Atkins, pending the results of an investigation. Meanwhile, activists in East Flatbush are organizing in the hopes of channeling the community's anger toward results. They want answers and they want accountability from the police. Demands, they say, as of now, are unsatisfied. Peter Rue, FSRN, East Flatbush, Brooklyn.
This is FSRN reporter Zach Brophy in Beirut, Lebanon. Free Speech Radio News has been an essential outlet for my stories about the crisis in Syria. I've reported from the ground in Aleppo and have also covered the spillover of the conflict into Lebanon, from the influx of refugees to kidnappings. But FSRN, along with the voices of people struggling for dignity, equality and human rights, could be silenced. Find out how you can support independent grassroots journalism at fsrn.org. Global stories, local voices. FSRN is an investment in independent news. Again, you can learn more at fsrn.org.
More than a week into the public comment period for the Keystone XL pipeline, more details are coming out about the outside firms that prepared the environmental impact statement for the U.S. State Department. The impact statement is required by federal law to provide an analysis of the environmental toll of the project, which aims to carry tar sands oil from Canada across the United States to the Gulf of Mexico. But three of the firms that prepared the report have ties to the oil and gas industry and specific companies that could stand to profit from the project. For more, we're joined by Steve Horn, contributing editor with Counterpunch. His latest article at DeSmog Blog looks at the companies behind the State Department's draft environmental impact statement. Steve Horn, welcome to FSRN.
Thanks for having me.
One of the contractors who authored the environmental impact statement is Environmental Resources Management Group, based in London. Tell us about the group's background and specifically its ties to big tobacco companies.
Sure. So, like you mentioned, I think the first thing to note is ERM Group, or Environmental Resources Management Group, although it's located in London, it's actually located in something known as the City of London, which is featured quite heavily in the book Treasure Islands by Nicholas Jackson as a fairly famous onshore, if you're located in the UK, or offshore tax haven for multinational corporations, in which they park their businesses there in that 1 square mile radius to avoid paying taxes. So that's the first thing to note. The second thing to note is ERM's historical role, at least in the 90s, affiliating itself with R.J. Reynolds and Philip Morris and doing studies on their behalf. And the ERM group itself has said openly that, at least in their 2000 version of their website, which I went back through the web archives and looked at, that they see climate change not as a real threat, but just as some sort of advocacy group to push back against in terms of studies. And they pretty much state it themselves in the 2000 version of the website, is it's about managing things, not about actually doing legitimate science.
And one of the aspects that you bring out in your own reporting, which ties to the tobacco companies, is using the strategy of doubt, either with public health information related to the tobacco industry or climate change, environmental or scientific findings in relation to this project.
Correct. Yeah, this has been, I call it in the article, the tobacco playbook, and that's exactly as you described, which is to make a two-sided debate out of something that's fairly one-sided. There may be some variations of the actual science, but there's sort of a legitimate scientific consensus right now. At least the book talks about climate change, and although climate change is a concern on the Keystone XL, there's also just a lot of other ecological issues in terms of water contamination, ruining farmland, ruining forest land, things that happen during actual tar sands extraction. That all these things are pretty much, you know, we look at them as a whole, there's a scientific consensus around this issue. What this report does is make it a debate, and you know, sadly, this is an actual government document now. So it has the stamp of approval of both industry, which it contracted the study out to, but also now the State Department. And a lot of the mainstream media has been reporting this as, okay, well, they said that it's environmentally sound, not questioning who ERM Group is at all. And actually, often not even mentioning that the State Department contracted this out to begin with, and that it wasn't even the State Department did it, but it was TransCanada, the corporation that is actually going to be building this pipeline if it gets approval.
So a government document, but prepared by these outside companies. Another firm involved is ICF International. It has ties to a New York advisory panel on hydraulic fracturing. And then a third company is Ensis Energy. Now, what are its ties to the oil and gas industry?
Sure. So three of Ensis Energy's clients include ExxonMobil, BP, and Koch Industries. And the former two, ExxonMobil and BP, both have huge stakes in tar sands extraction itself. They own a lot of property in which they're extracting the tar sands, after which it gets moved by a company like TransCanada to the next company, which is Koch Industries. Koch Industries owns refineries, particularly in the Midwest. In the state of Minnesota, they own the Pine Bend refinery. In the state of Wisconsin, where I live, they own four refineries. The oil or the tar sands is refined there into something that's more easily transportable, and then it will go down to Port Arthur to be exported. So Ensis Energy, one of the groups that did the environmental impact statement on behalf of the State Department, has clients that are going to make potentially billions of dollars off of the tar sands itself. It's a huge conflict of interest, and it should be questioned heavily whether or not basically we can view this with any legitimacy.
Journalist Steve Horn with Counterpunch and DeSmogBlog joined us to break down the companies behind the State Department's environmental impact statement on the Keystone XL pipeline. Thanks for joining us, Steve Horn.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And you can find a link to the full article on our website, fsrn.org. The small island nation, the Republic of Mauritius, marks the 45th anniversary of independence from British rule this week. But one group isn't celebrating. The Chagos community was forcibly removed from their homelands and brought here in the 1960s and 70s. They've been fighting to return home ever since. From Port Louis, Mauritius, FSRN's Raphael Kraft reports.
The Chagos people are about 1,000 miles from home. They were forced off their Indian Ocean islands by Great Britain some 40 years ago. The UK and the US built a military base on their most populated island, Diego Garcia. Chérubin Bancou is a Sega singer and Ravan player, the local drum. He was born in Mauritius right after his parents were forced from Chagos in 1967. We will never forget the graves of our ancestors we were forced to leave behind when the English came, he sings. Although he never saw the island where he was conceived, Bancou, along with his sister Geraldine, are trying to preserve Chagosian culture.
Our father showed us how to build and play the drum. In our family, almost all of us are musicians. My daughter plays the drum, my brother, along with his children, play as well. Even my grandchildren play Sega music.
Sitting next to the siblings on a small terrace is Willin, their 85-year-old mother. She remembers her life in the Chagos archipelago.
There were coconut trees everywhere. They were our main source of income. We were making oil out of the coconuts. The sea was all around with a lot of fish inside. There were a lot of birds, too. We were fishing. We had animals. We didn't really need money to live.
As time passes by, memories of the native Chagosians paint an idyllic picture of their homeland, a lost paradise. But life was hard there under British rule, as Mauritius writer Shehnaz Patel explains.
C'était pas le paradis, les Chagos, c'était une société...
Chagos was no paradise. It was a peculiar society. I wouldn't say that they were under slavery, but there was a commander from the colonial administration of the Morishu on each island. They were not paid in salaries, but with a quota of flour, sugar, and rice each week for working in the copra industry.
As more and more colonized countries were gaining independence in the 60s, the U.S. started searching for new territories to set up military bases. Diego Garcia, the biggest island of the Chagos Archipelago, was ideally located in the middle of the Indian Ocean. U.S. officials asked the British administration to rent this island under the condition that no population would remain on it. At the time, some 1,500 people had been living on these islands for five generations. Jean-Claude de Lestrac is a former Mauritius foreign minister.
Et les Britanniques, poussés par les Américains, vont organiser la déportation.
The Brits, who were pressured by the Americans, were going to organize the deportation of the Chagosian people. They started to empty the island step by step, forbidding people to come back after they had traveled for health or business reasons. And one day, they gathered the remaining population to inform them that the last boat will go and they shall board it. They also gathered the dogs, which they burned in front of the population, crying. They forced them to board the boat and abandoned them on the docks of the Seychelles and Mauritius, alone with their fate.
Les amène sur les quais de Port-Louis et des Seychelles et les abandonne là à leur sort.
While negotiating independence, the Mauritius provisional government sold Chagos to the British for £3 million. After years living in Mauritius slums, Chagosians, mainly women, started fighting for their rights, invoking UN Resolution 1514, which prohibits the breaking up of states by colonial powers. Again, writer Shehnaz Patel.
Les femmes avaient une personnalité, une place très forte dans cette société.
Women had a strong personality and occupied significant space in the society. Whereas men, when they arrived in Mauritius, it seemed that they were crushed by fate, against which they were powerless, completely lost. So women take the lead in this fight, organizing hunger strikes, facing anti-riot police. They showed a determination that I found immense and impressive.
Although the women leading this movement recently died, the struggle to return home continues. In 2009, the UK unilaterally declared the Chagos Islands a marine protected area, although exemptions were made for the military base on Diego Garcia. Chagos people and their supporters said the effort was aimed at stopping territorial claims to the islands. One piece of evidence supporting this was found in a WikiLeaks cable sent from the American Embassy in London to the US State Department. The cable describes a British official who said that establishing a marine park would in effect put paid to resettlement claims of the archipelago's former residents. He headed that the UK's environmental lobby is far more powerful than the Chagosians' advocates. The government of Mauritius challenged the marine protected designation, and earlier this year, the Permanent Court of Arbitration in The Hague agreed to let the case move forward. Another case filed by Chagos refugees against the UK moves forward in April. Raphael Kraft, Port Louis, Mauritius for Free Speech Radio News.
You can listen to the full song performed by Sega singer Cherubin Bankou on our website, fsrn.org. And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.